Okay, thanks very much for inviting me, and thanks to all of you for coming. Since this is a foundations talk, I thought it would be good to avoid technicalities and to try and make things as hopefully interesting as possible. So I will be talking about unsolved problems and the challenge of describing the universe quantum mechanically. Very much encourage people to interrupt and ask questions. So let me just begin, for those of you who are not cosmologists, by reviewing what we know. Which isn't that much, but it's much more than we did know. Even a little while ago. So let's start off with some observations. And I will be emphasizing some puzzles about the observations, which point to coincidences and strange features of the universe, which are, in my view, clues as to where we should be heading in fundamental physics. And hopefully, I will argue that quantum mechanics has certainly something to do with them, but probably in a way that hasn't yet been understood. So observations of the universe show us that it is unbelievably simple. In fact, you can argue that the structure of the universe is simpler than the structure of an atom. It really is the simplest thing we know. And in particular, it's, as far as we know, the standard model of the universe has six numbers. These seem to do a very, very good job of describing this, the universe on large scales. And so as any cosmologist can tell you, six is 4 plus 2. And four of these numbers describe the matter in the universe, the density of matter. So these are four densities. And two of these describe the geometry. So what is the stuff in the universe? Well, we have radiation. We have baryons. We have dark matter. And we have the cosmological constant, or dark energy. As far as we can tell, the universe is described very accurately by Einstein's equation, which relates the expansion of the universe. So if the scale factor of the universe is a of t, then the Hubble, what's called the Hubble parameter, is a dot over a. And Einstein equation relates the expansion rate of the universe to the density of everything within it. And I'm leaving out spatial curvature here because observations so far haven't shown any spatial curvature. It seems to be close to zero. So what are these densities? The density of photons is about, let me just define something. This, by definition, is 8 pi g over 3 rho critical. So rho critical is defined in terms of the Hubble constant. And if there is no spatial curvature, then the left and right-hand sides of these equations are equal. And so you can express all the densities in terms of the critical density. So density of photons is about 0.405 of rho critical. The density of baryons is about 0.05 rho critical. The density of dark matter is 0.25 rho critical. And by this equation, the density of the dark energy, or cosmological term, is about 0.7 rho critical. So those are the four numbers that specify the density of different kinds of matter in the universe. And then to specify the geometry, we have perturbations. Around a spatially flat homogeneous isotropic universe. So the background geometry is consistent with being spatially flat, Euclidean space, but which is homogeneous and isotropic. And and we have a power spectrum of these perturbations, which goes like some amplitude times k to the ns, with ns as spectral index. And we have a scalar is 3 times 10 to the minus 10. And ns is 0.97. And 1 would be perfect scale invariance. So the perturbations take this extremely simple form. They're nearly perfectly scale invariant, the same amplitude on every scale. They have an amplitude. This is the square root of that gives the RMS, which is about 10 to the minus 5. So the curvature of the universe on a given scale will be given by 10 to the minus 5 divided by that scale squared, so in the natural units. And that's it. That's 4 plus 2, which is 6 numbers. And that fully defines the standard cosmological model, now tested to very high accuracy in many, many different measurements. So the universe has turned out to be remarkably simple. There are a few anomalies at the 2 sigma level, almost 3 sigma level in some cases. But and those have to be watched closely in case they become convincing. But at the moment, this description holds very well. There are many zeros, okay, and zeros are big clues. Zeros might be clues to some principle which we don't yet understand. So, for example, the mean spatial curvature. It's consistent with zero on large scales. The tensor perturbations. And so just like the scalar power spectrum has some amplitude, the tensor power spectrum has its amplitude. And this this is bounded above, and in the right units, the RMS tensor power compared to the scalar power, assuming this scale invariance as well, is now less than 0.07. So for some reason, the universe emerged from the Big Bang with density perturbations, but not apparently with gravitational waves. I'm sorry. Thank you. So the power in the tensor perturbations is less than 7% of the power in the scalar perturbations. This is an interesting number, because when it falls below 0.05, I win my bet with Stephen Hawking. Inflation theorists were very excited a little while ago, where Bicep claimed this number was 0.2, and Stephen claimed to win his bet with me. Unfortunately, that was dust. And subsequent measurements have pushed the limit down to 0.07. It will very shortly go below 0.05. So I'm quite confident that I will be $300 Canadian dollars the richer. But this is really very interesting. I mean, a priori, why shouldn't the universe have come out of the Big Bang without some gravitational waves? It seems not to have done so. And this is already pushing inflation into a corner, that the simplest models are ruled out, and one has to make the models more and more contrived to avoid this. So that's an interesting emerging zero.
Had Arvin discovered, he'd also say he'd be pushed into some particular corner. And the point of any observation is to push you into the corner. You can't use that in itself to say an idea is a bad idea.
I'm not even going to go there. So, and then there are other interesting zeros, which is basically 1 plus the pressure over the density for the dark energy. So for a standard cosmological constant, the pressure equals minus the density. And that's because the stress tensor is Lorentz invariant. So the stress tensor is proportional to the Minkowski metric. And that forces this number to be zero. But observations, of course, bound this number. And I think right now, I mean, it's debatable exactly what the bounds are, because there's some mild discrepancies here and there. But this is certainly seems fairly safe. And future observations are probably going to take it down to about 10 to the minus 3. So this is a very interesting zero to watch, if it stays zero. And then this spectral index here, in principle, can run with scale. And in various models, it does. And again, this is limited. This is consistent with zero currently, but that might change. One of the most interesting zeros is the non-Gaussianity. Again, these primordial perturbations have some two-point function, which is specified by the power spectrum. But there's no reason a priori why they couldn't have a three-point function. And the limits on this are now becoming very interesting indeed, namely that the three-point function over the, so the sort of dimensionless three-point function, or the skewness, is now less than about 10 to the minus 2. OK, so the observational limit is that the three-point function is 1/100 of the sigma cubed. And so that's very interesting, that for some reason, these perturbations were really extremely simple. They look like a Gaussian field. And of course, that's encouraging for theories in which the origin of these perturbations is quantum mechanical and is due to the fluctuations of a free scalar field, as it is in inflation. So that's another very interesting zero. Within inflationary theories, this number is not zero. I mean, there are an infinite number of theories. Generally, it's not zero. In the simplest ones, it's consistent with this bound. But those simplest ones are in trouble, as I mentioned, with other measurements. So currently, you can still avoid this. You can still avoid this limit, but already a large number of theories have been disproved using that. So these are very profound clues that something extremely simple is going on in the universe, and we don't understand, we certainly don't understand it all. There are other clues. There are some amazing and puzzling coincidences. We have all these densities, and as I've told you, they're all comparable. I mean, within a factor of 10,000 or so, they all happen to be equal. And that's very strange, because they all scale differently with the size of the universe. Okay, so if we take the log of the density of each component and the log of the scale factor, I'm just going to write it as A, though actually it'll be a log scale. So this is radiation, which falls as A to the minus 4. And then here is matter, which goes as, so this is radiation. Did I call it R? I called it gamma. I'm going to switch to R for radiation. Matter, which goes like A to the minus 3. And then we have lambda, which is constant. So we live here, where the density in lambda is about twice the density in the matter. And so that's the first coincidence, is that this crossing point of lambda and matter occurred when the scale factor was about 0.75, what it is today. Okay, so when the universe was just a little bit smaller than it is today, the dark energy started to dominate over the matter. That's an interesting coincidence. Why is it that that happened so recently? But there are other coincidences. In fact, this point where the matter dominated, this happens 10 to the minus 4. It's also not exponentially far away. The universe, you know, started at zero and now is however big it is. But to find this event happening so relatively recently is a surprise. And then there's another event, which is that the density perturbations, the amplitude of the fractional perturbation in the density grows as soon as the universe starts to grow, as soon as the universe becomes dominated by matter. This is matter, A to the minus 3. So the amplitude starts to grow, and it hits 1 when the universe was about 10 to the minus 1 of its current size. That's when galaxies really started to form in great abundance. So all these numbers are, you know, to some extent of order unity. They're all a surprise that somehow things were set up in the universe for all of these coincidences to occur. The other one I haven't mentioned is that, of course, this matter is baryons plus the dark matter. And the dark matter is about 5 times the density of the baryons. And that's another coincidence, which we don't understand. OK, so there are lots of coincidences in this basic model. Everything is coming together at once, and we don't know why. So by the way, inflation has absolutely nothing to say about any of these coincidences. Okay. The second strange fact, if we ask what is the density of the cosmological constant in physical units, surely that's a very fundamental number. That's the energy in the vacuum in kilograms per cubic meter. But if we write it in quantum gravity units, it's 10 to the minus 120 m Planck to the fourth. And that's a very strange small number and positive. So that's very puzzling, especially since if we treat the standard model, if we take the standard model, we have 90 fermions in the standard model and 30 bosons. And here I'm not including right-handed neutrinos. I'm just taking the minimal standard model. There's this very nice coincidence that the fermions come in three times the number of the bosons, which we don't understand. But what this suggests, if we do the naive usual calculations of the vacuum energy density, which would be the density of the cosmological constant, this would be minus and then cut off to the fourth. So the sign is wrong, and the magnitude is wrong by 10 to the 120. It's not very impressive, or it is very impressive. It tells us that we're missing something very, very important and very fundamental. So I suspect we're simply calculating this number the wrong way. And part of the motivation of my talk is to figure out how to calculate it properly. And finally, there's a clue from LHC. Which is pretty curious, and not again not really understood, but again it suggests a coincidence or a bit of a conspiracy, in fact, which we don't understand. So in the standard model, of course, these fermions and bosons are not free; they interact with each other, and in particular with the Higgs field. And so the Higgs field has an effective potential. And we're all familiar with the symmetry breaking potential, the classical symmetry breaking potential, designed to give the Higgs field a vacuum expectation value of 100 GeV or so. And so this is V of H, V effective of H, which is the vacuum energy as a function of the value of the Higgs field. So it has its symmetry breaking minimum. We adjust the value at this minimum to be this value, the observed value of the cosmological constant. And we adjust the parameters in the Higgs potential to fit the mass of the Higgs field observed by the LHC. When we fix that those numbers, then the theory gives a prediction as to what the effective potential value is for all values of the Higgs field. And it's very strange indeed. It looks like this. It has a maximum at about 10 to the 10 GeV. It has a minimum negative at about 10 to the 20 GeV, which is suspiciously close to the Planck mass. And that's a pure prediction from particle physics. There's no knowledge of gravity involved. Okay, so there's a strange strange fact, a number of strange facts. One is somehow physics placed us here, whereas naively the lowest energy state is there. And two is that this minimum does occur around the Planck mass, whatever that means. There are a bunch of other coincidences which are related to this. There is a vanishing beta function associated with the potential curvature changing sign. And there are some other coincidences involving quark masses and so on. But maybe this is a clue that, again, something interesting and strange is going on, which we don't understand. Okay, so let us think a little bit about quantum cosmology. So we have at least two clues that the universe is quantum. One of them are these density perturbations, which look statistically just like they have the statistics of a free quantum scalar field with a Gaussian distribution. And secondly, we know this vacuum energy is actually non-zero, and it is important in the universe today. And the major contribution we know about, we think we know about, are the vacuum fluctuations in the known fields. And so that's a huge number. So it would not be a surprise if quantum mechanics was really necessary to describe the whole universe, and that's what I'm going to assume is true. So what is quantum cosmology? Well, this is a long-developed subject, but the basic object in quantum cosmology is you take a universe, by which I mean a three geometry with matter, and you propagate it forward to some other three geometry with a different distribution of matter, and this would be the propagator. So that's the basic object of interest in quantum cosmology. So I'm going to explain to you some new calculations of this object for the simplest type of matter, and explain that it has some very interesting and unexpected features. And by the way, this work is in collaboration with Stefan Helan, who used to be a postdoc here, is now at Imperial. And I believe this has just been accepted by PRL, even though I can't quite say that with 100% confidence. The referee now seemed to be convinced by our argument after a fair amount of back and forth. So this should be appearing in PRL shortly. It's on the archive in any case. So we're interested in studying quantum cosmology. The traditional approach, of course, is to calculate the Hamiltonian. Since Einstein's theory of GR comes from an action, it has a Hamiltonian, and one can consider canonical quantization of GR. That's the most conservative approach. But it has a strange feature, which is that the Hamiltonian annihilates all physical states. There's no time in quantum cosmology. If there was, it would contradict coordinate invariance. And so the fact the theory is invariant under reparametrizing coordinates means that the Hamiltonian has to vanish on physical states. Now, this equation has been a puzzle for a long time. And one of the puzzling features of it is that when I write it out formally, so this would be the three metric, it looks something like this. This is supposed to represent the density of matter. The point is that this equation is second order in derivatives, that the three metric, and in the simplest case, I'll use the scale factor of the universe as the time. That's the natural time-like coordinate on superspace. Superspace is the space of U's. So the size of the universe is the natural time-like coordinate. This equation looks like the Klein-Gordon equation, the free Klein-Gordon equation. Quantum mechanics is still linear. It's an amazing fact about quantum gravity. Even though gravity is a highly nonlinear theory, quantum gravity is a completely linear theory. And at least
what
if you...
What do you mean by saying it's linear
on the wave function? Yeah, so it's completely linear on the wave function. So I will do various tricks which rely on linearity. And so in particular, people often argue that you can't deal with the Klein-Gordon field as a Schrodinger wave function. And a lot of those arguments rely on interactions. But in this case, there actually aren't any interactions. This is a perfectly linear theory, even though all of this operator is highly nonlinear. The first problem with the Klein-Gordon equation, so the free Klein-Gordon equation, of course, looks like dt squared plus d squared. And let me just put that in for as an example. Then, as is well known, the question is what represents a probability in this theory? What represents the probability in quantum gravity? And strangely enough, this is a question that's never been resolved. We can work out what the wave function is, but there aren't really good candidates for the probability. Okay, so I'm going to propose a candidate later in the talk, but so far all proposals have very severe deficiencies. Okay, so the first thing you might want to propose is this. And let's pick A to be a time-like coordinate on superspace.
So, are you using the usual ADM composition here?
Yes, I am. I am. When you do canonical quantization, you naturally decompose the universe. So this is there's no choice of coordinates here. This equation is completely coordinate invariant. But I am using the ADM decomposition to derive it. When you look at superspace, it's the space of fields. It naturally has a time-like direction on the space of superfields. So at each x, at each point x, there will be one direction which is time-like, meaning that the original action has the wrong sign. So you can, for the kinetic term. So the action, if we write down the action for the scale factor of the universe, it comes in with a negative sign. The kinetic energy has the wrong sign. And then all the scalar fields, if they are normal scalar fields, let's call them sigma, they would have positive kinetic terms. But there's in gravity, there's one field at every point, spatial point, which has the wrong sign. So superspace in gravity naturally has this Minkowski-like signature. It's very fundamental. And it's basically why the universe is not static. Because there's no ground state. So there is a arbitrariness in the choice of time-like coordinate, just like in the Klein-Gordon equation. This is Lorentz invariant, and I can always choose another time-like coordinate. But you have to pick one. So this would be a natural guess as to what the probability is for finding a universe in the state U at this time-like coordinate A. But the problem with this is that it is not conserved. Okay, Okay, so it's easy to check that this Klein-Gordon equation essentially has only one conserved quantity, which is integral dx psi star I dt psi. And that would be the U1 current associated with the phase invariance of the action for psi. So this quantity is conserved under the Klein-Gordon evolution. But this quantity is not. So that's a sort of fundamental problem with unitarity. You implicitly, much of the literature is using this, and it means there's no real notion of unitarity. So for example, in the Hartle-Hawking papers or in other papers on the wave function of the universe, they implicitly rely on this, and there's no notion of conserved probability. Now, on the other hand, some people advocate using this because at least the total probability is conserved. But of course, the density here, the probability density here, is not positive. So again, it doesn't really make sense as a theory of probabilities. Either probabilities do not, well, probabilities don't add up to, are not guaranteed to add up to one. If they add up to one initially, they won't subsequently. Or they're not even positive numbers. So again, I'm going to, based on some experience with actually solving this equation, I'm going to propose a new probability in quantum cosmology.
Can I try to understand why this thing isn't conserved? So now you have an equation that it's...
Well, just to,
it's acting on the
Turing sorry.
Is equal to zero.
Yeah, sorry, what I should do...
It's not really evolving anyway.
Sorry. What I should do is this. When I say it's not not conserved, and actually I need this. So if I and also I would want to, yeah, that's it. So what you want is that the total probability is independent of the time at which you calculate it.
But then that. That A parameter is also just a parameter in the Hamiltonian there.
Yes. So if I write that out a bit more, the Hamiltonian would look like minus dA squared, and then there will be some positive operator here in everything else. And this is on the space U. And there may be some potential terms as well. Okay, so the point is that this quantity is not conserved under this equation. If I just take d by dA of this, there is absolutely nothing to guarantee that the answer is a total derivative. And the way it works in the Schrodinger equation, of course, it is a total derivative, and that's why probability is conserved. So, yeah, this doesn't really make sense as a probability. Or if it does at one moment, 1A, it won't work at another. So it's a very, very basic problem, which has never been solved. It's well, yeah. So in Einstein GR, you treat those as the same. So it's over three metrics.
And you take modular gauge transformations.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Okay. So rather than leap to a conclusion in some formal way, I was interested in studying this very pragmatically and looking at the simplest case. Okay, and strangely enough, we found that the very simplest case of any kind of matter which could be thought of had not been studied. In quantum cosmology, I think there are two communities. One is very formal. One is very pragmatic. The pragmatic people basically have a classical picture in mind. The formal people have a very formal approach. And somehow, because of that, nobody bothered to study the simplest case. So I'll tell you the motivation I had is that it's very, very obvious from the point of view of what I've explained, what should be the most interesting simple case. Okay, a flat, I'll do a curved universe. The simplest case is matter which is conformally invariant. Okay, why is that interesting? Well, of course, conformal invariant matter doesn't really know about the expansion of the universe. Okay, conformal invariant matter means that the whole setup is invariant under changing the size of the universe. And so furthermore, that is the matter which dominated the universe near the singularity. As far as we know, it was radiation dominated. Also, as far as we know, the only meaningful quantum field theories are ones which have which are conformally invariant in the UV. Those are the only well-defined ones, the only complete ones, ultraviolet complete ones. And so for both those reasons, it's very natural to say, I'm just going to study matter which is strictly conformally invariant. And of course, as soon as you say that, well, what is the big singularity? It's the moment when the size of the universe was zero. But if the matter doesn't care about that fact, maybe the theory still makes sense. Okay, and so that was the initial motivation for our investigations. And so let's just take as an example a flat radiation-dominated universe. Flat FRW radiation-dominated universe. So it's a very simple first step. Let's just solve the Friedman equations for this case. And what you find is this geometry, ds squared is eta squared minus d eta squared plus dx squared. So the geometry of the universe with perfect radiation fluid is just Minkowski space, this flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. It's Minkowski space, but scaled by the time coordinate squared. Okay, so when I first noticed this, it was quite striking, because what is this? Well, it's a bounce. Okay, it's obviously a bounce. It's a smooth bounce. If I follow eta backwards to the singularity, the metric does this. The three geometry, let's just write it as a squared. It hits zero and comes back. So okay, there's one bad point where the universe vanishes, but it's really not so terrible. It's not so singular as you might imagine, and in particular, if you believe that complex numbers are important in physics, which I do, it's very natural to consider this in the complex eta plane. And so the metric vanishes here, but if I choose any path which avoids the singularity, the evolution is absolutely unique. Okay, so because the Einstein equations are differential equations, the only place for a singularity to arise, this is true even if I study. No, there's no Euclidean. No, this is real time. There's a minus sign here.
So why you're assuming eta is a complex number?
So Einstein equations are differential equations in eta. And I can evolve them along some path in eta.
Eta is also
the three geometries. Okay, so this is also considering complex. We'll do more of this in a moment. Okay, this is only a clue, but it's a clue that suggests the extension across zero is may actually be well defined. So this is a bounce. Yeah. So the dynamics of Einstein's theory with conformal matter is to naturally give rise to a bounce. And if you ask why does this happen, it happens for a very simple reason, which is that the trace of the Einstein equations look like this. On the left-hand side, I have the Ricci scalar. T would be 0 for conformally invariant matter. The trace is 0. This Ricci scalar goes like A double dot if this is A of eta squared. This goes like A double dot over A squared. So the Ricci scalar vanishing means A double dot is 0. And that leads to the bounce. So if I put in spatial curvature or anything else which is subdominant near the singularity, it's irrelevant to the argument. The argument holds for anything provided radiation dominates at the singularity. Okay, so that motivates a careful study of the quantum theory of Einstein gravity and conformal matter. So we're going to start off with Einstein gravity. This will be the Lagrangian for radiation. And I'm going to put in some conformally coupled scalar fields just as an example or a proxy for the matter. And I'm going to pick them to be free fields just so that I can solve everything exactly. Okay, so this is conformally invariant. The radiation, perfect radiation fluid is conformally invariant. And its Lagrangian is just minus the density. This is this is conformal coupled matter. An example of this could be the Higgs. We don't yet know what the coupling is to gravity, but plausibly that is right. We think we know there are four scalar fields in nature. And so we think we know such a thing exists. So it makes sense to try to consider this combination. Now, the first step in tackling this is a horribly nonlinear theory, obviously. But the first step in tackling it is maybe a little bit surprising. And this is to introduce explicit conformal invariants just at a classical level. Which is to say, let's replace the metric, this metric here, by the following. And so that's just a replacement which introduces this field phi. It's a new field. Now, why am I doing that? This transformation won't change any of the matter because it was conformally invariant. I have to transform the matter fields correspondingly to leave that part of the action invariant. But this changes Einstein's action into something rather nicer, which is this. Okay, so by doing this, I removed the mass parameter in Einstein's theory, and I replaced it with a scalar field. And now this new theory has an obvious invariance, which is that if I change the scalar field and the metric in just such a way that the conformal factors cancel, It must have an invariance, because that's how I derived it. So this is what we call a lifted theory. Okay, a vial or a conformal lift. Now, why do you do that? Well, the point is I want to describe the expansion of the universe, right? That's rather complicated in this language. I will get A double dots and so on, things like that from this term. But if I go to this conformal frame, this lifted frame, I'm free to pick G and phi in any convenient matter, in any convenient manner. So we can choose a conformal frame in which the universe is not expanding. The universe is static. And that is only for homogeneous and isotropic backgrounds. Okay, so homogeneous and isotropic backgrounds just have the single scale factor. We could just choose a conformal frame in which the metric itself is static. So there's no time dependence in the metric at all. What happens is all the time dependence has gone into here. Okay, so I've just traded a metric with all its nastiness for a scalar field, which is much easier to treat. And now you look at this, you say, well, if the metric is static, this thing is trivial. R is trivial because it's time independent. And what do I have? I have a free field theory. And so I can do the path integral exactly. And so what I do here is write the metric in this static frame and this is static and R is 6 kappa, just some curvature, so it could be closed or could be open if kappa is positive or negative, or it could be flat if kappa is 0. And then the action is just the volume. And by that, I just mean the coordinate volume. If I integrate against the spatial metric, I get the total coordinate volume. I'm going to put the universe in a box. It might be a torus, it might be a sphere, in which case I don't need to put it in a box. It might be an open universe, in which case I will need an appropriate box. But let's leave that number in there, the coordinate volume. And then I have this action. So the phi is now the proxy for the scale factor of the universe, and it has the wrong sign kinetic term, as it should. And then we have this lapse function. And the lapse function is there in order to enforce the constraint, constraint equation in GR, the G naught naught constraint equation. So now what I do is define X alpha. This looks like a relativistic particle in Minkowski space. So I will define this. Okay, so we're going to assume there are m of these scalar fields. There's only ever one wrong sign scalar field. And this tells you that they're like the coordinates of a particle on Minkowski space. And then I'm going to define this parameter m, which is just the volume of the universe times the density. Now, the density, in this conformal frame, in which the universe is static, the density is a constant. Okay, so that number m is just a constant, and it's literally the mass of the universe. Okay, so the action, and obviously if I make the volume bigger, I get a bigger mass, and I'm free to choose that volume, at least for the flat or open cases. there's some choice in how big the volume is. So the action is m over 2 integral 1 over n x dot alpha, that's just the usual kinetic term for a free particle. And then we have minus n 1 plus kappa x alpha. So for kappa equals 0, this is precisely the action for a free relativistic particle. And for that, I know how to calculate the path integral. So I think in view of the fact that I'm running out of time, I can draw some conclusions and tell you about my proposal. And then anyone who wants to leave can leave, and I'll keep going. OK. So that, of course, the calculation I've described is the most trivial part of the problem, because that's just dealing with the background. I want to solve a general metric propagating. So what I will tell you later is how you include, how you start to make the metric generic. Okay, so the first step in making it generic is to get away from isotropy. Okay, so an isotropic flat metric would treat all of these the same. Okay, the next step is to say, no, they're not the same. Let us put in, let's do that. Okay, so in effect, we're allowing the different directions to have different scale factors. So as I will discuss, you can study that case. You can solve it exactly, just like you can the other one. And you find some very interesting properties of the Hamiltonian and of the quantum mechanics. And so that's a sort of unexpected treat. It turns out that when you do this, you end up with a Hamiltonian as a function of A, which is d2 dA squared minus constant over A squared. This is basically forced on you by scaling, because there was no scale introduced at all. And so the potential that comes out of these anisotropy modes has to scale in the same way as the kinetic term. So it's a very special case, plus m squared. This is the Hamiltonian. And of course, h hat psi is 0. Now, there's a funny thing about inverse square potentials, which is that they're invisible. Sandu's nodding. Few other people seem to know that. But you know, if you wanted to hide from me behind, if the only way I can see if you're there is to throw a tennis ball, all right? And if it comes back with some time delay, I know you're there. Right? So you're walking along that wall, my eyes are closed, I throw the ball, I try to catch it when it comes back, assuming there's only one dimension, and if it hits you, there will be a time delay or a time advance. But you can hide from me. Okay? So all you do is introduce inverse square potential, and you hide behind that. Okay? Inverse square potential is completely invisible to somebody throwing a tennis ball. The ball slows down. So you might think it took longer, but it bounces sooner. And those two effects cancel completely, so it's invisible. So inverse square is a very special case where the potential itself is invisible to scattering. This is true for repulsive inverse square. In this case of studying quantum cosmology, you also need to deal with the attractive case, So the repulsive case for the potential looks like this. This would be C positive in the normal quantum mechanics picture, right? So in normal quantum mechanics, I'd multiply the whole thing with a minus sign and then interpret this as the energy. And so the potential is C over A squared. It turns out that when you deal with scalar fields and with anisotropies, they all contribute to this constant. And for some values of the momenta of those variables, the constant is repulsive, and for some it's attractive. So this problem has occurred everywhere in the quantum cosmology literature. People derive this Hamiltonian in a million different ways. What it has been traditional to do, okay, which I believe is completely wrong, I'm not very diplomatic, I'm sorry. Here's A, right? A goes positive and negative. And of course, the classical theory only depends on A squared, so you should include both positive and negative A. So people noticed this. They typically studied cases where C is positive, and they said, aha, that's an infinite barrier. And so what do? They advocate setting the wave function to zero at the infinite barrier. So Maldacena advocates this. Thibaut Demour advocates this. Many other people advocate this. It's a very big problem with this. Anyone tell me what it is? It's at least one problem.
Can you normalize the wave function?
That's not such a huge problem to normalize it. You could deal with, this as if it was plane waves. That's not the worst problem. If you force a wave function to vanish at one point, it tells you the wave function is real. Up to a complex phase, it's real. It can't carry momentum, and so it cannot describe an expanding universe. Okay, the variable that is conjugate to this is the is PA, which classically is A dot, and this is I dA. And there's in a real wave function, and certainly in a real wave function, you can't. There's no net momentum. If you like, there's a left moving and a right moving mode with an equal and opposite momentum. So that seems like a big problem. You just can't describe an expanding universe if you do that. So we've done something a little different, which is to allow modes to travel in this potential and to go through it. And again, the idea is the following, that let us not be rigid that A is real. Let us allow A to go in the complex plane. Okay, and then you find that I can propagate a mode around here, and all sorts of wonderful things happen. Namely, a universe comes in and collapses, has negative momentum, and goes out again. And the answers are completely insensitive to this constant C, essentially because of this invisibility property. So so you see, it's sort of surprising for the negative case, because you say again, well, with a negative potential, surely I speed up as I go across it. There should be a time advance. Should see the potential. But semi-classically, that is not what happens. You run in towards zero, and now you find the classical equation is ill-defined. It has a singular potential. So make the classical solution have a small imaginary path. And then it turns out that in the complex A plane, it comes in, it goes down the imaginary axis, and it comes back. And this piece of the classical complex trajectory exactly introduces a time delay, which cancels the time advance. And so positive frequency in is positive frequency out, and everything seems completely well behaved. The second problem with this proposal to just force the wave function to be zero is the DeWitt norm, which I already told you about, is the only conserved norm, is zero. if the wave function is zero. So your only measure of probability, which makes sense, is happens to be zero. The third problem with this prescription is that it violates the correspondence principle, that you find if I make M very large, meaning high energy, very massive universe comes in and bounces off, there's a phase shift. Quantum mechanically, there's a phase shift with this boundary condition, which goes to a constant, even as M goes to infinity. So there's no real correspondence between this version of quantum theory and the classical dynamics. And finally, there's a sort of worse problem, which is that if you force the wave function to be zero for positive C, you still have to deal with negative C. And for negative C, for a certain band of C, for C between 0 and minus 1/4, both modes are vanish. Both modes vanish at A equals 0. So now I have two modes. So you have a discontinuous number of modes if you adopt this prescription. Okay, and there are other problems. But basically, for many reasons, I think this idea of just forcing the wave function to be 0 at A equals 0 doesn't really make sense. So that is not what we did. We adopted this analytic prescription, which does give a unique propagator, and it seems to make sense. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
That's a well-defined problem you can solve without any
ambiguity.
And then you send the cutoff to infinity.
Yes.
Is that compatible with the answer you're
Yes, getting? You wouldn't see the cutoff. The answers at this level, the answers are independent of that cutoff.
No, but there's a unique prescription that can come out of just putting a hard cutoff.
Well,
there's a unique answer that will come out of that. Is that the answer?
No, you see, I don't think there is a unique answer in the sense that, am I going to insist A is real?
Well, I mean, there's a quantum mechanics problem with the finite potential cutoff that you may not like that.
This is not quantum mechanics, by the way.
Okay. All right.
This is not quantum mechanics because it's like quantum mechanics, but it isn't equal to quantum mechanics because H psi is zero. Okay? There is one value of M, and that's a conserved quantity. So the universe I'm studying has a particular value of this eigenvalue. I'm only interested in the wave function for that eigenvalue, not interested in any other states. Okay, so it's not like quantum mechanics in this sense. In quantum mechanics, an unbound, you know, this if C is less than minus 1/4, it makes no sense because there's an infinite unbounded spectrum. But that is not what you're interested in for quantum gravity. This is not the Schrodinger equation. Okay, so I won't show you the gory details of the propagator, just to refer you to our paper and our forthcoming paper. We also studied perturbations around this metric, generic perturbations. And what we showed is that there is a unique definition of positive frequency modes such that positive frequency in is positive frequency out. There's no particle production, even as the universe goes across this bounce. And furthermore, we extended it to nonlinear order in the perturbation expansion and showed that it even works at nonlinear order in generic perturbations around this background. So I think I'm going to end just by telling you, so what? So we computed the propagator. Okay, and the propagator would be A, and let's call them chi, these matter fields. Let me just call it U because it includes the three geometry. A prime U. So that is perfectly calculable, at least perturbatively. So I have this propagator. What do I do with it? Okay. I still need to solve the problem of probabilities. Okay, so I think I've learned something about the quantum dynamics of this theory by studying the propagator, but what do I actually do with it? I want to know how to use it. So this is my proposal. The proposal, after all, we're after a calculation of the probability of some state in the universe. So there's some psi A U. Now, we also have, you see, the A comes into the metric only as A squared. So you can equally well write down psi minus AU. Okay, there's no real distinction between A and minus A. And so this is my proposal, is that if I want to calculate the probability of some wave function, psi, what I do is I take psi star A U, then I use the DeWitt inner product. I'm writing this schematically as d by dA, but this can all be made completely coordinate invariant. And then I have my propagator, g of a u a prime u prime. And then I need to take another inner product, dA prime, psi of a prime u prime. And implicitly, I'm going to integrate over u and u prime. OK, so my claim is this is positive. And it's conserved. It's independent of a and a prime. And so that.
Did you define g? Which propagator did you use?
Feynman.
Feynman.
Yeah, G Feynman. Yeah, I will explain that in detail. I wanted to reach the conclusion and allow people to leave, but I'm happy to. The next step will be to explain exactly what fixes G. There is a sense in which, diagrammatically, I'll draw a picture like this. I have a universe at minus A. I have a universe at A. I take the inner product with psi, take the inner product with psi. And basically, this is equal to the square of this diagram. And that's the probability. OK, so the universe, in a sense, comes out of nothing. You sum over all four geometries coming from nothing to the final four geometry you're interested in. You then take the inner product with the state you're interested in. And that quantity is conserved. So it's positive and it's conserved, but it employs the propagator. Okay, so the way I avoid this problem of the probability of psi is by utilizing the special properties, the existence of this propagator. OK, so any questions? And then I will go back and show you how to calculate this why that Green's function is the Feynman propagator. Yeah.
OK, I don't know. Maybe you don't like it. But I think in the framework you are working, it's like the scalar tensor gravity, which is very much the action I see. It's very much like the string gas cosmology that we have. And of course, there is a duality here, like the duality you have here. Your conformal frame is like the Hagedorn frame there, the string frame, which everything is static.
Any theory with a scalar field is the same.
Exactly.
Any theory.
So my point is that apparently you have done all of your calculations in this supposedly conformal frame, not the Einstein frame, which is not the real physical frame. I mean, have you looked at your equations in the Einstein
frame? I started in the Einstein frame.
No, you choose the conformal frame.
No, look. I started in the Einstein frame. Yes, I started with Einstein gravity.
You said you choose the conformal frame in which the universe is static.
Yeah, that was just convenience to do the path integral, because the path integral is Gaussian in the
conformal. So you transfer it back to the Einstein frame again?
You can, if you want. It's much easier in this frame.
Of course, I know. But
So for example, if I only deal with one scalar field, in this description, the one I gave, the action will be minus phi dot squared plus chi dot squared, right? The kinetic terms. And then phi and chi decouple, and it all becomes easy. If I go to Einstein frame, I say then it becomes minus a dot squared plus a squared sigma dot squared. And you have to find a way of dealing with this nonlinear term. You can. And in fact, in the calculations, we do use this. So we use both frames. But
in the Einstein frame, this dual picture that you drew doesn't look like
this one?
That way.
No, this is Einstein frame. This is A. This is the scale factor of the universe.
I doubt it. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you like, I can explain the whole thing in this frame and never go to these variables. The real advantage of these variables is actually when you have more than one extra scalar field. When you have one scalar field, you may as well just do it in this variable. You see, for a free scalar field, you can actually quickly eliminate this term because you have that the momentum is p sigma is constant. Okay, so the Hamiltonian becomes pa squared minus pa squared plus p sigma squared over a squared. That's where the 1 over a squared potential appears. Okay, so actually, you know, when I wrote down this equation for here, the a I'm talking about here is the Einstein frame scale factor. So if you have more than one scalar field, it turns out it's much easier to deal with in this form because, it's special for various reasons. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with Einstein frame. And the level of I'm working at, you wouldn't, you know, I treat myself as free to change frames. I'm not worrying about conformal anomalies or anything like that yet. That should come, but not yet. So choice of frame is not, I don't believe it's an issue. No, absolutely. Absolutely. So when you do the matter at a certain level, you should worry about the conformal anomaly. I'm assuming conformal invariance.
Okay, so you're still in the radiation dominated?
Yes.
So I'm trying to understand what this equation, what this quantity means conceptually.
The
quantity. So let me try, and then you can tell me where I'm getting it wrong.
Yes.
So you have a certain state that you're interested in. It's a classically described state. It's sort of an eigenstate, almost.
This psi.
Yes.
So imagine I want to know what is the probability for the universe to have such and such a geometry or this Hubble constant or whatever.
Right.
What I would do is construct the wave function which represents
that particular
class of classical universes.
So
I construct that that wave function, and then I take this inner product, and it will tell me the probability.
If it was standard sort of non-quantum gravity quantum theory, then that would mean you're performing a measurement or something onto that basis or something, onto some corresponding basis, and you're looking to see what the probability was for that
measure. Correct, but that's right.
Here you don't have that picture, I assume.
I'm not judging with it. Why not?
Okay, great, so you do have that picture.
I don't see why it matters. I want to, you know, I have some method of constructing my psi, which represents the observed, the state of the observed. So for a particle, it would be delta of x minus.
So you could imagine that I make an observation or someone does, maybe not me, but and determine that certain a and a certain u are seen.
Right.
So this then tells me the probability calculated from just to propagate. There's no, because there's no wave function in here really, because you've really got our eigenstates. If you're calculating a probability in standard quantum theory, you have a wave function and you hit it with an eigenstate and then you see what the probability is. Whereas here you just have the eigenstate.
No, but you can view it the same way. You can view it the same way in ordinary quantum mechanics. I can view any probability would just be, you know, chi, psi. So I construct some state chi, which for example would be, if I observe the particle at position x, I would say chi is a delta function of x minus x naught at the time I make the observation. And at any other time, it's the time evolved version of that state. But this inner product is the probability to see the state chi, given that I'm in the state.
And so chi. And so your primed and unprimed are the chi and psi, is that right?
No. One way to think about this is the Green's function is specifying the quantum state of the universe.
Oh, so that's your psi in some sense. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry, I should have. I've used bad notation. This should be chi.
Good.
And this guy is specifying psi. And then it's analogous to this calculation.
Okay.
And by the way, it's. I think it's very clear that for a large universe, this will obviously reduce to the standard Schrödinger norm. So for the state chi, then to a very high approximation, chi of A and U, it is a solution of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, the Hamiltonian constraint. This will be E to the IMA chi of A and U, or chi S. And this guy will be the normal Schrödinger equation. It's just the standard way you recover the Schrödinger equation from the Klein-Gordon equation. So then I will get that this probability is, in fact, this squared.
In the thing you have written there, so now what you said, this is conserved as you vary A or A prime.
A or A prime, yes.
If you go back to the non gravity quantum case,
mm-hmm.
what would that conservation correspond to over there? Is there some analog over here?
Here?
Yeah.
Yes. So chi t would be the state at time t,
right.
And psi at t. And this, of course, equals chi psi
so it's sort of
at zero.
So they're sort of like you're trapping a solution. Sorry, you're trapping a state and an eigenstate in time.
Yes.
And you want that probability to stay constant.
Yes.
And
it does in quantum mechanics, and it does here. Yes. Okay, any other questions? Yep.
Why should anybody who is not interested in a conformal model be convinced by your proposal?
Well, first of all, everybody has to be interested in conformal matter. Because Maxwell is conformal, Dirac is conformal. In fact, the standard model is almost conformal, right? The violations of conformality have come from the Higgs mass, one parameter, and they come from running couplings, okay? Which is certainly in the UV. Two of the couplings go to zero, right? The SU2 and SU3. So they have conformality. There's one coupling which diverges, which is hypercharge, and that's a Landau pole. That's a very fundamental problem. But no, it's plausible that at some level, conformal invariance is a fundamental principle. It's true we don't yet know how to write down physics which is conformally invariant and have spontaneous breaking of conformal invariance, but that's a very attractive idea. So I don't make any apologies for conformal. I mean, if you ask for how do masses arise in the standard model, it arises through spontaneous breaking of conformal invariants. The Higgs field gets a VEB. Well, of course, that's sort of cheat in the standard model because you introduce a mass which brings the scale in, but still. I don't think one has to apologize for being interested in conformal theories. I'll tell you something. This is, now you may think this is speculative, but I have something much more speculative to say, which is I began by telling you about all these coincidences, right? How on earth could I explain those? And then as Yakir has been telling us so very interestingly over the last couple of weeks, in quantum mechanics, you know, it's different than classical mechanics. You have the freedom to specify the final state. And so what I'm doing is getting the initial state out of the Green's function, and I claim there's a completely natural and unique way to do that based on the path integral. It's not the no-boundary proposal, but I nevertheless claim it's better. What is the state chi? Okay, what is that state? So you could sort of just be pragmatic and try to work out things today, or you could say, no, I want the real thing, the real state of the universe, and I think you have the freedom to specify chi in some future boundary. When you study that, it's very interesting. So it turns out these analytic properties that positive frequency in is positive frequency out are totally connected to the conformal invariance of the radiation, okay, directly connected. In the far future, we have the cosmological constant dominating everything. That introduces a potential like that. That's all it does. That's also a very, very special potential. And it turns out that I can impose a boundary condition, which is, I would say, pictorially, a little bit like this. That here's the Big Bang. This is working in a conformal frame where I've stretched out the singularity, not that one. This is the Einstein frame. This is the other conformal frame. You can impose a boundary condition of pure outgoing modes in the far future of the universe, okay? Which is basically forcing the universe to end up in a de Sitter phase in the far future. You're allowed to do that in quantum mechanics. And I think that's very interesting. It might shed some light on how we should be calculating the cosmological constant. So I'm fairly convinced the standard way of calculating the expectation value of T mu nu in the quantum field theory vacuum, you know, that seems to really not work. This using post-selection, I think one will get a different answer, and it's worth exploring what that gives. So obviously, you could say I'm very optimistic to hope that some post-selection is going to create all kinds of coincidences today, but I think there's a chance, and I think there's no chance within the standard frameworks. So that's why it's interesting. So everything is up for grabs. The rules are up to us to make, as long as they make sense. I think, you know, we should play around with this and see if it produces, if it's consistent with the universe we see. But I was going to say something else provocative, which is that about string theory. So string theorists focus on, you know, do quantum gravity. Okay, so you might say, why did they never do this? Well, string theorists do quantum gravity, but strictly perturbative and strictly ignoring the dynamics of the background, or not, well, except for a few. Generally, string theorists do not take into account the dynamics of the background. Usually, they just ruin it by putting the universe in ADS and forcing a rigid boundary. So it really has nothing to do with cosmology at all. They're throwing out all the interesting degrees of freedom. And I would say, you know, if you try to use string theory to study the singularity, it's like using a microscope to study the universe. I mean, a telescope is a lot better. You need to take the whole thing into account. And doing perturbation theory on some microscopic scale is extremely unlikely.
The universe was a microscopic size. Then.
What?
Okay, the universe was a microscopic size, so.
Well, yeah, you Not really. Yeah.
So what's your best?
Most string theorists don't even work in time-dependent backgrounds.
I know.
People
I know.
Say time-dependent backgrounds are too difficult, so we just ignore them.
So,
I believe they may not be so difficult. We know that quantum gravity in flat space can be made finite by adding counter terms at every order, okay, which introduces free parameters. Whether that can be done in cosmology is not known. It's an interesting question, but it may be true that you can make a perfectly consistent expansion where you add counter terms order by order with the corresponding parameters. Nobody has done the calculations to check.
Mm-hmm. What's your best defense for using complex value scale parameter in cosmology?
Okay, good. So it's a good question. My point of view is that variables in quantum mechanics are very naturally complex. If you think about geometry is a classical notion. As soon as I write down a path integral, it is an integral along the, you know, if I write down the path integral, let's say I'm dealing with some quantum mechanical system X, and I write down the path integral. So the path integral involves the integral of X at each time along the real axis. When you want a semi-classical description, and certainly in the universe, that's what we want. We want a picture of the, we want an approximation to the geometry. We don't want to integrate over all completely wild geometries. We want to do that in principle, but in practice, we actually want some kind of approximation to the geometry. Now, given that you're doing a path integral in this coordinate, I mean, it is an integral, and what we're interested in are saddle points. Saddle points for integrals are generically complex. And that is the best classical approximation to the path. So in quantum mechanics, I do some path integral between an initial state and a final state, and I ask, what is the dominant saddle point? As soon as I ask that, generically it's complex. So again, this is a point which Aronoff and Sandu and many others have emphasized, is that if you know, path integral is a post-selected, it's a pre and post-selected amplitude. That is what it is. Psi initial at T initial, psi final at T final. That's a pre and post-selected amplitude. It's an integral. It's an infinite dimensional integral. It generally has saddle points, usually an infinite number. One of them dominates. And that one is your best classical picture of what's going on. And that will generically be complex. So I think anybody who expects quantum GR to be described by a real metric is certainly not talking about a consistent semi-classical approximation. That's why all this debate about firewalls and so on and so forth, I think, is completely missing this point, that the geometries which dominate, if you treat them consistently and semi-classically, must be complex, not real.
You're going to solve the problem of black holes as well?
Sure. Well, you know, cosmology is easier than black holes. It has a lot more symmetry. So I don't know why people spend all their time on black holes. It's a harder problem. Cosmology is the biggest symmetry you can have.
Hawking is your close friend,
doesn't he? He pretty much agrees with everything. He agrees with all these criticisms, at least when we're in the same room. And he didn't have any objection to this. I have explained this guy. He didn't have any objection. It is an exact calculation, so you can't really argue with it at this level. I've not put in interactions. It's only free fields and so on. So there's no argument about what the propagator is. There's no argument about
so,
the fact
so
that...
So can you find the propagator in your paper?
Yes.
If I don't want to take the time.
Yes,
on it.
Yes. So the main point is that even though A equals 0 is singular, if I want to insist on geometry, the actual dynamics of the theory coming from the action do not have any, you know, four homogeneous isotropic universes do not have a singularity at A equals zero. When you introduce anisotropy, they do have a singularity. You get Kasner-like behavior.
Yeah.
But again, that has a, it's a very, very particular potential. This 1 over A squared potential, which is quite remarkable. That,
so 1 over A squared is the feature of the three dimensions.
It's a feature of the fact you haven't put any scale into the problem. There's no scale. And so these two terms have to scale the same way with A. So if you study, I put in conformal matter, it's a flat background universe, I then allowed everything to happen, no scale can appear. So it's inevitable as a consequence of that. And then this, I could talk more about why there is this weird property that positive frequency in is positive frequency out, that's necessary for this to make sense. And. But I think I've said enough. Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you.